It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
World leaders join Rwandans to mark the 20th anniversary of the 1994 genocide. An emotional Oscar Pistorius takes the stand as murder trial defense. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In Rwanda, 100 days of official observances of the horrific genocide of 1994 began Monday with a ceremony in Kigali with international leaders, including UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in attendance.
On my first visit to the Kisoji Memorial, I heard and felt the silence of death, the silence of all those lost, and the silence of the international community in your hours of greatest need. Many United Nations personnel and others showed remarkable bravery, but we could have done much more. We should have done much more.
President Paul Kagame and Mr. Ban joined in lighting a national flame of mourning that will burn for 100 days. That's equal to the amount of time ethnic Hutu militia rampaged across the country, killing some 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. At an international forum on genocide Sunday, Rwanda's government repeated remarks that France played a direct role in the genocide. Mr. Kagame picked up that theme again Monday.
The people who planned and carried out the genocide were Rwandans. But the history and root causes go beyond this beautiful country. This is why Rwandans continue to seek the most complete explanation possible for what happened.
France denies any responsibility for the genocide and says the accusations go against the reconciliation process between the two countries. President Obama condemned what he called a deliberate and systematic effort by humans to destroy other humans. His spokesman is Jay Carney.
The world's failure to respond more quickly reminds us that we always have a choice. The president believes, and the United States believes, that in the face of hatred, intolerance, and suffering, we must never be indifferent. We must remember the humanity we share and work together as an international community to prevent atrocities and to bring an end to genocide once and for all.
In Rome, Pope Francis Sunday said he wanted to express his paternal closeness to the Rwandan people and encourage them to continue the process of reconciliation. Two Europeans working for the United Nations have been shot dead in Somalia's Puntland region. Sources identify the men as Simon Davies of Britain, a former Scotland Yard officer, and Clement Gorisson. Puntland President Abdiweli Mohamed Ali told VOA a mentally ill security guard shot the two as they arrived at an airport in the city of Galkayo. He has been arrested, an investigation underway. South African runner Oscar Pistorius took to the stand at his trial in Pretoria, South Africa, Monday. Before beginning his testimony, Pistorius offered an emotional apology to the family of model and girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp.
I'd like to apologize and say that there's not a moment, and there hasn't been a moment since this tragedy happened, that I haven't thought about your family. I wake up every morning and you're the first people I think of, the first people I pray for. I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the emptiness that I've caused you and your family.
Prosecutors who ended their case last month say Pistorius shot Steenkamp intentionally at his Pretoria home last year. The defense says Pistorius thought he was shooting at a nighttime intruder when he fired his gun through a bathroom door. The government of Guinea says the death toll from a recent outbreak of Ebola virus has now reached 95, with more than 150 confirmed cases. In Ghana, however, there was relief after the suspected Ebola case of a 12-year-old girl who died last week turned up negative, according to Health Minister Sherry Hani Atiyah.
And the samples of the blood, that they analyze, is negative of Ebola virus, and also negative of any common viral fever.
There is no known vaccine, treatment, or cure for Ebola. Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission has found that security agents unlawfully killed 8 civilians in a September raid in Abuja on a suspected Boko Haram sleeper cell. The commission says there was no evidence those killed were armed or terrorists. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of the stories you've heard can also be found and read online at our website, voanews.com.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A South Sudan ruling party official urges more targeted sanctions on the government.
Somebody like me would welcome what President Obama did, because it is us in Juba who have pushed the international community so hard for us being stubborn not to accept to reach an agreement where the people of South Sudan are yearning for that.
Rebecca Nyandan is a leading member of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement. Meanwhile, South Sudan launches a national platform for peace and reconciliation. There is another sign of division within Zimbabwe's opposition MDC and the politics of Ebola outbreak in Liberia.
You know, the Ebola situation in Liberia is no small situation, and it's only right for me as a human being to be alarmed about it. And we expect that our president would be here in a time of crisis.
Benito Ure is a businessman and would-be presidential candidate in Liberia's 2017 presidential elections. Oscar Pistorius takes the stand at his murder trial in South Africa. And funding shortage impedes humanitarian aid to displaced Syrians. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The leading member of South Sudan's ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the SPLM, has called on the international community to follow America's lead by putting additional pressure on the government in Juba in a bid to help quickly resolve that country's conflict. Rebecca Nyandang, widow of SPLM founder, the late John Garange, welcomed President Barack Obama's executive order that paved the way for U.S. sanctions on anyone threatening the stability of South Sudan. Nyandang tells reporter Peter Clotty that it is the responsibility of President Salva Kiir's government to reach a negotiated settlement with the rebels.
Somebody like me would welcome what President Obama did, because it is us in Juba who have pushed the international community so hard for us being stubborn not to accept to reach an agreement where the people of South Sudan are yearning for that. Those people who are suffering under the trees, those people who are in the refugee camp, the displaced people's camp, none of us as leaders are thinking about them, and the rainy season is very near. So the international community is frustrated, and they were pushed to that. So what Obama administration have done, I welcome it.
But an official of your government in South Sudan, in Juba, specifically said that the U.S. is meddling.
You know, our government doesn't know what they are talking about. They always criticize anybody who tell them that what you are doing is wrong. If you take off your clothes and you are walking on the street naked and you are told you are naked, do you want to tell people that you are not doing that? So they are the one pushing the international community hard to do that, because the human rights is speaking.
So you believe that there should be more sanctions by other Western countries or other African countries, because there seem to be no clear sign of progress at the peace negotiations? Is that your stance?
Especially individual sanctions is very important, because they say that the international pressure has gone down, so they're okay, they can do whatever they want to do, and there are no more killing, no more war, so they can be stubborn in Addis Ababa. But if there is international pressure, I think they would listen.
You blame the government, but it takes two to tango. Don't you think the rebels need to share the blame in the ongoing conflict?
I can say that, but you know who's wearing the hat? The president is the one who's supposed to resolve the problems, whether he's the one who's supposed to take the blame or to take the achievement. If it is the achievement and negotiation has been achieved in Addis Ababa, the achievement goes to him. So the rebels are carrying guns, and they are the people that he's negotiating with. And he's supposed to see how he can bring them in Addis Ababa so that they can negotiate, so that the lives of people are safe. So the responsibility entirely is in the hand of the government, not the rebels. But you know, for the government, they need people who carry guns so that they can negotiate. This is what I'm seeing today.
So you are calling for more international pressure on both sides to settle the conflict?
That's right. Because, you know, the government is very stubborn. The international community and us, we were calling for the release of political detainees last time, and it was put in the agreement that the release of 11 plus one who was under house arrest, Dr. Peter Adwok, they were supposed to be released. They want to release 7 and left 4 and one under house arrest. Now the international community is calling for the rest to be released, but they put them into court, where these people, the court is going on their favor. Secondly, the seven who have been released, they are denying them not to participate in the negotiation. And this is where the problem comes from.
Rebecca Nyandin is a leading member of South Sudan's ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the SPLM. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotte from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. South Sudan Vice President James Wanying Iga says the government is working toward an agreement with the opposition, speaking at an event over the weekend to launch a new organization called the National Platform for Peace and Reconciliation. Iga said he believes a peace deal will be reached soon. His comments also come on the heels of President Barack Obama's executive order threatening sanctions. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more for VOA from Juba.
Vice President Iga says he hopes the announcement of the platform will help speed up the third round of peace talks in Addis Ababa, which are postponed until the end of the month.
The issue is we got to be fast enough and to be realistic about time. And the issues are actually clear. Whatever we cannot debate in Addis Ababa, we can postpone this, you know, for the National Reconciliation and Healing Conference. So I believe we can actually agree.
Anglican Archbishop Daniel Dengbol is the chairman of the Committee for National Healing, Peace and Reconciliation, one of the three bodies organizing the platform. He says a peace deal may end the current fighting, but the conflict will not be over until both sides sit down and talk.
Political leaders can make deals and reach decisions, but this will not last unless people's voices are heard in those decisions. Our role is to provide space, include everyone, listen to the multitude voices that make up the nation of South Sudan.
Bull says they'll go to churches and communities across the country and ask for people's advice about how to move forward. He says they will distribute surveys and ask for people's opinions starting this week. They plan to hold similar events in other state capitals. Bull says the government and various religious groups are supporting the effort.
The platform is not a fixed entity, but an open space where all who are concerned with peace and reconciliation can find a home and a voice.
Bull says it will culminate in a National Reconciliation and Healing Conference to be held in Juba after a peace agreement is signed with the anti-government forces. The conference will include the top leadership from both sides, who will be invited to talk through the issues that led to the current crisis. Iga says, although the talks are delayed, he believes peace is right around the corner. But he says he does not believe it will hold unless both sides are willing to forgive each other. For VOA News, I am Mugumi Davis Rakaringi in Juba.
With an estimated 151 cases and 99 deaths reported from Ebola in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, health officials say the disease is becoming an epidemic in West Africa. In Liberia, it appears Ebola has become political. On Saturday, businessman and would-be presidential candidate in the 2017 presidential election, Benoni Yure, accused President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of abandoning the nation for an overseas adventure in the midst of the Ebola outbreak. Yure called on the president to cut short her current European trip and return home to lead the effort to combat the Ebola outbreak in the country. President Sirleaf said in a statement on Saturday that she is being briefed every day by the Minister of Health and his team. But Yure tells me he stands by his call for President Sirleaf to return home.
You know, the Ebola situation in Liberia is no small situation. In fact, there are four cases of it reported about 2 miles from where I live. And it's only right for me as a human being to be alarmed about it. And we all believe that in such an emergency, we believe that the president should have forfeited all other obligations and concentrated on the lives of Liberians. But, you know, others might see it differently. But we stand by what we said, and we hope that she will see reason to cut her trip short and come back to Liberia. It's a crisis, and we expect that our president would be here in a time of crisis.
I think, Mr. Uret, the comment that was made also by the presidential press secretary is that the issue of Ebola should not be political, and that the president doesn't have to be in the country, that issue is being handled by the Ministry of Health.
Well, the first thing is I wouldn't go and exchange a word with the press secretary or the president. Look, the fact of the matter is that we do have a crisis in Liberia. Whether I'm a farmer today or I sell scratch cards, it's irrelevant. The major factor here is that I am a Liberian. And there's pride and dignity in labor. If this little boy, P.I., can get up and insult me by virtue of what I've done for my country and what I've done for him, how many probably his relatives are employed through the sales of scratch cards, you know, and what I've done to my country by being a farmer. If being a farmer is a disgrace, then it's right for him to say that President Carter, who was a peanut farmer in America, he rose to the seat of presidency. You know, what about a little country like Liberia? You know, when there's an attitude of the present government where, you know, as soon as you say something, not necessarily against the government, but that doesn't favor the government, they unleash the dogs at you.
So, Mr. Urid, let me ask you, I'm reading somewhere suggesting that you might consider running for president of Liberia. Is that true?
I am going to run for the presidency of Liberia. And come 2017, at the end of 2017, I believe you will hear that I am the next president of Liberia.
So what do you say to people who say you are making these remarks because this is all politics?
Well, you've known me for almost 20 years, and I have not really gone out to say anything negative about the government. But when the lives of Liberians are threatened, I would speak.
Benonai Ure is a businessman and would-be presidential candidate in Liberia's 2007 presidential elections. He was speaking with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 8th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Divisions continue to rock the Movement for Democratic Change formation of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, despite his pronouncement recently that all is well in the party. The most recent division came to light with the so-called Renewal faction calling on Tsvangirai to step down to make way for a new leader in time for the next elections expected in 2018. MDC spokesman Douglas Wanzora says disciplinary action will be taken against the leaders of the so-called Renewal faction.
These were very junior people in the party, and they cannot seek to undermine what is so sacred in the MDC, the unity of purpose of all the progressive forces. Our leaders held the press conference about 2 weeks ago and announced to the party members and to the country that they were working together, that there was party unity, and that they were supposed to be party unity. But you do get some malcontents, especially the naughty ones, who just want to make headlines by doing things which are negative to the party. There was absolutely no need for that press conference. There was absolutely no need for some people to try to undermine what the party has been trying to build for a long, long time. The MDC is the only change agent in Zimbabwe. The people of Zimbabwe are suffering. And therefore, they look at the MDC seriously as a party that can deliver them from poverty and misery. But this playing with the people's struggle is unpardonable. And this is done by people who may or may not know that it is CIO and ZANU-PF who are behind these squabbles. And people can get used by CIO and ZANU-PF without knowing it. And we really appeal to the MDC supporters not to be hoodwinked by these shenanigans. The task at hand is very, very big. President Tsvangirai announced that there must be unity in the party. He announced that there must be unity of purpose of all progressive forces so that we get rid of the dictatorship.
What are you going to do? Are you going to take any action against them?
Well, from the way they behaved, I don't think they really want to be members of the MDC anymore. I don't know. But our National Council is sitting this week, and we will just inform them that this is what happened, and we see what will be done. But it is regrettable that people behave so irresponsibly, especially where some of them are actually representing Honorable Mangoma, who is going to be appearing before the disciplinary committee.
Douglas Mwanzora is the spokesman for the MDC formation led by former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. The murder trial of South African runner Oscar Pistorius resumed Monday, with defense lawyers launching their case. Pistorius took the stand in a dramatic highlight of this already intense trial. Viewer's Anita Power was in the courtroom. She files this report from South Africa.
Before Oscar Pistorius began to testify in his own defense on Monday, he told Judge Thokozile Masipa he had something he'd like to say.
I would like to take this opportunity to apologize to Mrs. Tsienko, to Reva's family, to those of you who knew her earlier here today. I'd like to apologize and say that there's not a moment, and there hasn't been a moment since this tragedy happened, that I haven't thought about your family. I wake up every morning and you're the first people I think of, the first people I pray for. I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the emptiness that I've caused you and your family. I was simply trying to protect Reva. I can promise that when she went to bed that night, she felt loved.
Mr. and Mrs. Steenkamp are the grieving parents of model Reva Steenkamp, Pistorius' girlfriend of 3 months. The athlete is charged with murdering her at his Pretoria home in February 2013. He says he mistook her for an intruder when he shot 4 times through a locked bathroom door. The prosecution says he meant to kill. Since that awful night, the athlete says, he's suffered and has been prescribed antidepressants and sleeping pills.
I'm scared to sleep for several reasons, but I have terrible nightmares about things that happen at night, where I wake up and I can smell blood, and I wake up to being terrified.
As he continued to speak, describing his early life and his mother's sudden death when he was 15, the athlete struggled to hold in his emotions. He grew more confident describing his upbringing, even smiling wistfully when he told of his mother's insistence on treating her son, who was born without fibula bones, just like his able-bodied siblings. He spoke of her encouragement as he tried sports in school, even though he said he wasn't good at most of them. He spoke of his mother's support when he was bullied at school. He talked about a catastrophic 2009 boating accident that made him reevaluate his life. In any other context, this would be an inspirational tale of a young man who overcame a disability to reach the heights of success. Pistorius, after all, was the first double amputee to run in the Olympics at the 2012 London Games. Pistorius spoke of the encounters with crime that he and his family have endured. He said intruders once ransacked his father's entire house. He said burglars stole a TV set from his mother's place, and that his father had been carjacked twice. He said his own home was robbed in 2005, with the robbers taking a TV set and a laptop computer. Defense lawyers will likely use these incidents to help explain why Pistorius, fearing another break-in, fired 4 shots into his bathroom door. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports, and here is Marco Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on Ghanaian football. Ghana football coach James Kwesi Appiah is full of praise for the Ghana Football Association, allowing him the latitude to handle his job without interference, Appiah told the Accra Media. Meanwhile, Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyantaji, pointing out how the just-concluded CAF FIFA seminar in Johannesburg, South Africa, is of constructive value to Ghanaian football.
This is about the structure for football associations. It looks at the key personnel that we need to run an effective football administration, and this includes the technical director, the general secretary, the president, and the roles that they are supposed to play to complement each other's effort. We have discussed and shared a lot of experiences here, and we've learned a lot that will go a long way to improve the running of football back home in Ghana.
Now, everyone is looking at the Black Stars going to the World Cup. I wouldn't want to delve too much into the allowances and how they are being paid. How is the preparation getting ready? I want to look at the overall, which is more important.
Okay, the preparation for the team is on course. It started right after our qualification to the World Cup, so the coaches have been going around monitoring players and evaluating their performances with their club size, also engaging their coaches and technical handlers and managers on how to motivate and get the best out of these players. Just last 2 weeks, we also sent our entire technical team on attachment to England. They were with the League Managers Association, Liverpool Football Club, and so forth and so on, where a lot of learning points were made there. They shared experiences, also learned a lot from how a professional club and professional football is managed and run. Now, we're coming back home, and we expect that at the end of the European football season, we'll have our players around the 18th, and then we'll do a non-residential camping session in Accra. Then the team will travel to Rotterdam, camp there for a few days before playing Holland on 31st of May. Then on 1st of June, the team travels to the United States to play one more opponent before the coach concentrates on sharpening the rough edges of the team towards the World Cup. So by the 12th of June, the team will be in Brazil, ready to play the first game on the 16th of June.
That was Kwesi Nyantechi, president of Ghana Football Association, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a very good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, April 8th.
Dear viewers, the Break Africa, the signal become a fashion over the years. Sadly though, when disruption in power energy occurs and the nation is still in the darkness, and the Algerian government is not at peace in trying to impress on the people that it is a handwork of vandals. And I do think that President Goodluck is in a time to let government to realize the dream of boosting generation and distribution through its concourse and discourse. Then it must tighten the security news on power, infrastructures, and fast track the machinery for apprehending and bringing to justice the bad guys. Thank you. Your loyal listener, Bruce Ajew, from Makurdi in Benue State of Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Two Europeans working for the United Nations have been shot dead in Somalia's Puntland region. Multiple sources identified the men as Simon Davis, a British citizen, and former Scotland Yard officer Clement Garrison. France says Garrison was a French citizen, while other sources identify him as a Canadian. In an interview with VOA Somali Service, Puntland President Abdi Wale Mohamed Ali said a mentally ill security guard shot the two men Monday as they arrived at an airport in the city of Galkayo. South African runner Oscar Pistorius has taken the stand at his trial as his lawyers try to convince the court he is not guilty of murdering his girlfriend. Before beginning his testimony Monday, Pistorius, talking through tears, offered an apology to the family of Reva Steenkamp. That's it for this Tuesday, April 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very lovely Tuesday.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kHz and 15580 kHz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.